Hello again, everybody. This is Phil Lairness, your friend in podcasting. It's the wee small hours of the morning. Dean Haglund and I are busy packing up, getting ready to hit the road. In a few minutes, we'll be driving from Los Angeles to Sacramento, the state capital, here in California. We've cleared plenty of room in the back seat, so we hope you'll all pile on in and join us on this road trip as we hopefully make it to Sacramento in time to appear on Good Day Sacramento, a local news television program. But before we hit the road, we have some leftover business from last week. What you're about to hear is a pre-recorded answer that Dean and I gave to a couple of questions from longtime listener and good friend of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, Matt Giles, who wrote to us asking about the movie Titanic and about director James Cameron. I am reminded of something that our good friend John Champion, the host of DVD Geeks, told me about this week. He reminded me that when the movie Titanic was first released, what, some 15 years ago now, many fans of the movie did not know that it was based on historic incident. Here's how you can tell the difference between the movie Titanic and the actual luxury ocean liner Titanic. One was a disaster that ruined the lives of many people, and the other is a ship that hit an iceberg. Here now is the question sent to us from Maddie Giles.
The Chilpack Hollywood Explanation of the Week.
Seeing it again on the big screen after all these years, I realized that the film works for me on a variety of levels, despite its shortcomings. 3D worked in places, didn't in others. Just happy to experience it in the theater again.
Right.
He was wondering what we both thought of the film, and also wanted us to use this film as a jumping-off point to discuss proper conduct on the set of a film. So first, what are your immediate thoughts about the movie itself?
I thought it was all right. I liked the idea that it was told, it was framed within researchers looking for a diamond and then telling the story of Titanic through the eyes of Miss Rose. And Celine Dion, hearing that just ruined it for me.
I've got a couple really ballsy choices about this that I think would have made it a much, much cooler movie.
Oh.
One is you just have a montage at the beginning of everybody saying, it's unsinkable, it's unsinkable, it's unsinkable, cut to the guy yelling, iceberg dead ahead. You've got an hour and
that's
a half movie then that's a lot of fun. I hate the casting of the movie. I hate the casting for being so nail on the head. I think, you know what, you wanted to have an interesting movie, even at 3.5 hours, switch DiCaprio and Billy Zane. Have Billy Zane play the romantic lead and have DiCaprio play the asshole. That would be really interesting to me. As far as Titanic movies go, it is inferior to the 1950s movie
Night to Remember. Yeah.
So that's my thoughts on it.
Yeah, but it was highly researched. I mean, they properly...
That's fine. That's whatever. Just, you know, look, and I've never bothered to say it because, you know, look, I know everyone loves it, and that's fine. Everyone's entitled to love it.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm entitled to find it interesting.
There you go.
There's nothing... And we like things that reveal ourselves to us, and so clearly I'm not that kind of romantic guy, I guess. I'm sorry. Anyway, I also don't like it, in fairness, because the man who made it and the way he went about making it makes it hard for me to like it.
Yes.
And this was what Maddie was getting at, which is wanting us to discuss what is proper and improper behavior for a director on the set. Is there times when a director's anger is ever okay? He brings up Titanic because the stories are legendary.
Legendary.
People being in the water for 16, 17 hours, not being allowed to even go to the bathroom.
Right.
People who died driving to and from set because they were falling asleep because they wouldn't put them up down south of the border in Mexico where they were, so they were having to commute.
From Ensenada back to L.A.,
Yeah, for every day after 17 hours of shooting.
True.
There was so much stuff.
And the first AD who lasted 174 days worked forever after that because all he had to say is, I did 174 days on Titanic, and anybody would hire him.
So
because it was hellish. So is that ever proper? I say no. I mean, this is the ends justify the means, and means justify the ends.
Here's the thing with a director and an actor. No, absolutely not. You know, there is nothing so important that we should ever allow ourselves to be come demeaning and dehumanizing and mean. And a lot of these people are rewarded for this kind of behavior so long as the movies work, and that sends altogether the wrong message, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not fair to them either, because then they make a bomb and no one will hire them again because they made a bomb and no one likes them.
Yeah, right? That's the thing.
It will be rewarded so long as the movies are successful. So no, it's never okay. However, we need to be careful in that, as with anything, any behavior is okay if it's welcomed by the people on the receiving end of it.
Right.
Harassment is only harassment if it's unwanted. That's the definition.
Right.
And in the case of direction, Peter Falk tells the story of making Mikey and Nikki because he was asked, what is great direction? And he used the example of Elaine May on Mikey and Nikki. Uh-huh. Because he had this scene where he had, I won't do spoiler alerts, but he has to do this horrible thing to John Cassavetes' character.
Right.
And he couldn't find it. He couldn't find it. He goes, but I love this guy. How can I go here? How can I go here? And finally, Elaine May pulled him aside and said, you know, you got to remember what he did to you in the scene, but remember what he did to you. Remember how that felt to you. Yeah, I get it, but I'm having a hard time dropping into there where it's real. Yeah. So, you know, she leaned in, whispered to him something really, really close, and he couldn't hear. So he leaned in even closer. She reached out and bit through his upper lip. Hit blood everywhere, and she said, that's what he did to you. Places.
Ah.
And so with mouth bleeding and everything, she it was action, and Peter Falk was able to get there.
Right, and so he appreciated
to the, and to his death, he would always use that as an example of great direction. Mm-hmm. Would most actors enjoy that? No.
No.
Would the guy who was best friends with John Cassavetes and worked with him all those years like it? Yeah, he probably would. That's the way they played. But that's the point. It's play.
Right.
And we might look at that kind of play as being, oh my God, that's violent, that's dehumanizing, that's whatever. If they want that, if that's what they enjoy, after all, we can't cast. There are people who are masochists.
Yeah,
there are people who are sadists, and we cannot cast stones.
I know.
However, this is the point. There's a contract
that is
unwritten.
Yes.
Between anyone in any workplace, which is, I am not going to cross your boundaries.
Right.
Somehow Elaine May knew that was not crossing Peter Falk's boundary.
Right, and the problem with this story is then suddenly that becomes a tool in a director's bell who's up and coming, and he's biting directors, and suddenly it's Nicolette Sheridan, and you're in court down over at City Hall, right? So you're not, you know, these stories, as good as they are, need also...
So in other words, when in doubt, if you cannot be absolutely sure of what someone wants or needs, then when in doubt, do nothing.
Exactly.
Well, another one of my favorite stories, Spielberg has traditionally, I think, always been thought of as kind of a gentleman on the set. How about the story with Karen Allen on Raiders of the Lost Ark where she couldn't scream? She could never scream. They could never get a usable scream. So when they're in the Well of the Souls with all the snakes, she recalls thinking, why is Steven walking around on the catwalks up there while we're rolling? What's going on up there? And all of a sudden, a gigantic snake got dropped onto her by him, and she let out a blood-curdling scream that they use whenever they need a scream in that movie.
Right,
it came from that. Now, that's kind of a mean trick. And
at the same time,
they needed it.
It needed it.
And she knew they needed it.
Right.
I myself was in a really awful situation on one set.
Uh-oh.
Because I always have gotten... well, I won't say the film. But I have always gotten along very well with my crew, with my actors, and have fun. I think that we're all there, you know, and the work should be as much fun as possible. It should be play. That said, I made the mistake of assuming a friendship with someone who I had not really known very long. I've made that mistake on other times, and it's bit me in the ass. In this case, it was because the person was recommended to me by someone who was very dear to me. So therefore, I had these feelings and this assumption of friendship with this person. And I didn't know that for much of the shoot, this person was using that as carte blanche to behave quite badly.
I see.
and thinking they could get away with it because, and when it did get back to me of how there was kind of a morale problem because someone was able to behave in such a way with my authority, I then took this person aside and at the same time loud enough where everyone in the crew could hear it, ripped this person a new one mercilessly.
Uh-huh.
And it improved the morale of the set dramatically.
And his performance?
Well, this wasn't an actor.
Oh, good.
And at the same time, I was the bad guy in all this. I created the problem from the beginning. So my yelling at this person, needed as it needed to be, it was all my doing.
Right.
And it was horrible. It was horrible that I did it to this person, but I had set this person up really in the first place by assuming a friendship. And so it was an important thing, which is in a workplace environment, you want to, you want everyone to be able to have fun. You want them to have the freedom to appreciate their own contribution.
Right.
Because then they'll really start to bring you more. And at the same time, a professional distance has to be maintained. You are not friends. You are colleagues. You are business partners in this. Now, maybe there is a long-standing friendship that's brought to bear on it.
Yeah.
But remember, it's about how you work together first and foremost.
And then I got a story that is the antithesis to all of this.
The antithesis to all of it?
Yes. Well, okay, so when I got the X-Files, right? Did I ever tell you this?
I don't know.
So a guy said to me, oh, hey, you got your own series. Congratulations. What's your freak out day? I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, you know, you're going to pick a day to freak out. No, I don't do that sort of thing. Yeah. No, you're the lead actor. You got to have a day. Like, just here's what you do, he said. Go to right now, you know your shoot dates. Just randomly put an X on some day that you're on set. And then that day, that's the day you freak out. So the third AD will knock on your trailer door. Sir, we're ready for you on set. You slam the door saying, I'm not fucking going out there. You scream at that person and you slam the door. And then the second AD will come and you don't even open the door for that. First AD, Mr. Hagler, is there a problem? Yeah, this I can't, no. And you slam the door again. Then by this time, they said like three things will happen. First, there'll be a phone call. You're shooting in Vancouver. There'll be a phone call down to LA to all the producers. Something's up with Dean Haglund. There's, you know, he's not coming out of the trailer. Something's up. You know, everybody then is put on red alert. What the hell? Oh my God! Right? Then the first AD, everybody is now talking on set. All the crew is talking. The lead actor's not going to. What happened? He seemed like not such a nice guy. I don't know. And then the director will get out of his chair and he'll knock on the door. And then you invite him in. You say, hey, yeah, come on in. Listen, it's just this scene. I don't know what it's about. Blah blah blah. He'll talk you through and then you go, hey man, that's great. Cool. I'm totally cool. And you come out. Six things happen, he said. Now the producers know that you're taking this shit seriously, that this is emotional, that you're emotionally connected to your work, and that you're not just phoning it in. The producers are like, he's an artist, he's an actor. B, the director then starts getting work because he's the guy who can talk difficult actors out of trailers. And that gets Dugan work, who directs every Adam Sandler movie. The only reason that's the same director in every one of them is he's the director that can come in and talk difficult actors out of trailers. And he admits that. I've talked to this guy in person. And then C, this makes the crew work harder because they realize you're not phoning it in, so they're not phoning it in. And everybody will step up their game and make a better TV show. And all of these things will fall in place if you just freak out one day. And I said, that's ridiculous. I never did it, and I regret it to this day.
Wow.
I know, right?
That's a great story.
Yeah. And I've told this to other producers, and they said, yeah, that's true. This is why you always hire, like, Madsen or Sean Penn or Tom Sizemore. You hire these troubled, crazy people because you think that's where the artistry comes from.
And the other part of it is true. You know, he asked about, Maddie asked about directors.
Right.
But even with the director, you do have to throw the bats around sometime. The coach has to throw the bats around.
The coach has to, bro.
And you have to. And the time when you want to do it as a director, and I have done it on every set I've done it, the time you want to do it is when focus is getting lost.
Right.
Either late in the day or
late in the shoot often, when separation anxiety starts to take over, which always happens, people start to make mistakes and flub up when they're in that separation anxiety of, oh, I don't want this to end. Summer camp is almost over.
Right.
You know, that's when you have to throw the bats around and you have to throw a tantrum as the director, as the coach, because
that brings focus.
It brings focus. And if you don't have focus on a set,
you don't get things done.
Well, no, people also get injured.
Oh, right.
There are a lot of lights get broken. There's dangerous things. Someone will get hurt.
Right.
That's when you do it. You use that tool to increase focus to make sure that everyone is stepping carefully and thoughtfully. That's when you do it.
From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood
Hour.
Dean Haglund, what does it mean that we are somewhere in a secret location?
Why, it means, Phil, that we are in the parking lot of IDEXX Laboratories here in the City of Trees, Sacramento, California, or West Sacramento, California.
It is, in fact, West Sacramento. We are just outside the security gate for the local CBS affiliate.
And we'd be inside the security gate if we weren't 3 hours early for our morning show. Good morning, Sacramento.
Good day, Sacramento.
Good day.
Yeah, we arrived early enough for good morning, Sacramento. Yeah. We are supposed to be on good day, Sacramento.
Right.
The 10 o'clock hour is all for us.
Right. Why couldn't it have been good afternoon, Sacramento? Because that would have been closer to our screening time.
Good day, Sacramento, though, is a much beloved, much watched show here in Sacramento. And I guess it's the top-rated news show and the top-rated morning show. It's all these things. And they're giving, I think, an entire hour over to us. We gave 2 hours over to the fine local establishments here in West Sacramento, because we did. We arrived so early. Google Maps said 6.5 hours from a certain historic building in downtown Los Angeles,
right,
to the CBS affiliate here in West Sacramento, and instead it was not even 5.5 hours. And I had, of course, padded an extra hour just in case.
Right. But now that gives us the opportunity to sit in a parking lot and wait.
Where public parking is prohibited.
Right.
But as you said, this is a podcast emergency.
Right. So we're getting our podcast recorded at a wonderful window of opportunity. Let's look at it that way. Not that we're just killing time, but a window of opportunity to record our show.
You know, this already has been a remarkable installment of our weekly podcast when you consider the fact that it was about 15 minutes before the opening theme song.
Yes, because we had, yes, last week's show.
We had a Chill Pack Hollywood explanation of the week left over from last week's
right.
show.
And instead of cramming that all into one show, we split it up over two.
We actually... something else was called to my attention from one of our loyal listeners, Mr. Pliskin.
Oh, Mr. Pliskin.
Who actually posted something about pranoia. Do you know of pranoia, Dean Haglund? Pranoia will destroy ya?
I know of paranoia.
You know of paranoia. Pranoia is an actual psychological description for people who believe that others are conspiring behind their backs, under cover of darkness, conspiring all around them without them knowing it, in order to make everything better in their lives.
Yeah.
Well, one could say it's the opposite of paranoia. I find way too many similarities to consider it opposite. It's almost like a mirror image, is really, when you think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Two sides to the same coin.
Exactly.
Maybe.
Making it better, making it worse is a value judgment that, you know, what seems bad it might be good for you later on.
Right. So, I mean,
paranoia.
I guess if I leaned one direction on this, I would lean towards paranoia, because I do fundamentally believe that everything works out the way that it's supposed to.
Right.
That does not mean that it works out the way we might like it to. It's that there is always an opportunity. There is always a chance to learn something.
Right.
Our future successes will be based on our past failures. Our greatest achievements will be based on what we learned during some of our roughest times.
Right. So therefore,
so everything serves in some way. That kind of, if we can call it optimism, I actually refer to that as realism, to really be able to look at things and say, okay, no matter how much I might like this or dislike this right now, giving myself to any emotional reaction to what's going on is not going to deepen my relationship to it.
Right.
Rather, asking, how does this serve? You know, probably does do that to a much better degree. Where I don't lean towards paranoia, of course, is I don't actually think anyone out there is particularly that worried about things working out for me.
Right. So, but therefore you have the ability to change your paranoia to paranoia, and then from there just disregard it. So it's a two-stage removal of your paranoia.
Well, I actually believe most of the time everyone is pretty well concerned with what's going on in their own head. Occasionally people are concerned about what's going on in their heart or other organs.
Yes.
For the most part, though, most people are spending most of their time dealing with the myriad voices that we all have that sound often like other people, but really are the voices we carry with us. I think people are pretty much occupied by that most of the time, and too occupied by that to really care one way or another.
Right.
About what's going on with other people. Where I lean towards paranoia, if this were the definition of it, is that I do see order in the universe.
Ah.
I do see a pattern of unfolding in everything.
Really?
There is both chaos and there is...
Pattern. Fibonacci scales and that sort of thing.
Right, right.
See. Okay, well, that's handy way.
So anyway, I thought you might get a kick out of that. Mr. Pliskin sent me a link to an article about paranoia, and this has been, I found references to this in music and in psychology going back 30, 40 years or more. So this has been an actual term for quite some time.
So paranoia will not destroy you, but will technically destroy my enemies, making it better.
I guess. If the idea, though, is that paranoia will destroy you.
Right.
Because, you know, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me. You know, that phrase, right? But still, paranoia might serve you in the long run, though, if you give yourself over to paranoia. It will always destroy you.
Right.
If you give yourself over to it.
Right.
I would think if one gave oneself over to paranoia, which is simply a mirror image of that, it is such a belief, such an intense belief to give yourself over to, that I could see that destroying you as well.
Really? Or just like, everybody's helping me, so no matter what, thanks, mister, and then hooray, that guy helped me, and then you just merrily march through your life.
By how hyper you got while describing it, I can already see the ill effects of paranoia. Hey, there's a quote I want to do, share with you. And this is about presumptive Republican nominee at this point, Mitt Romney.
Right.
If Mitt Romney is to generate more excitement and sacrifice from Christian conservatives, he must, quote, demonstrate a genuine and solid commitment to the core values issues, said Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Mr. Perkins said Mr. Santorum had vaulted into conservative favor because, quote, he passionately articulated the connection between America's financial greatness and its moral and cultural wholeness, and recognize that the economy and the family are indivisible. And, you know, I've been reading John Adams. And reading so much about how many of the framers of our Constitution and many of our fathers of liberty in this country did make this comparison between economic health and moral health.
Yes.
That, you know, solid citizenship and solid family was indistinguishable.
Okay.
From a working economy.
Right.
So I found this, so that's why this kind of caught my eye. The next part, though, is what I really was fascinated that this person, Mr. Perkins of the Family Research Council, would say this. Intensity is going to be a big problem for Mitt Romney, Mr. Perkins said in an interview, comparing an obligatory vote for Mr. Romney, I guess, on the part of Republicans, right?
Right.
To avoid the alternative of Mr. Obama, he compared that obligatory vote of voting for Romney instead of Obama, he compared it to, quote, eating your vegetables.
I happen to like vegetables.
Exactly.
So...
And I didn't even just read this all as a joke, because what I was stunned by also in reading so much about the inner thoughts and the writings of so many of the great proponents of liberty from centuries ago is how many even back then were talking about for the not only health, but for better moral health, the eating of animals was going to need to decrease with every generation.
Ah.
John Adams himself wrote about that, that he hoped that with each generation, the inclination towards killing animals and eating them would diminish until the point where it wasn't done at all, because both, again, for taking care of resources, our own health, they already knew then that eating what you grow was healthier than eating animal flesh, and also for the morality of a culture, of a nation.
Wow.
It was important. And so here we've got this
the metaphor
Family Research Council, and it vegetables are just an obligation.
Wow. That's shocking. And why? What does the Family Research Council actually do? Do they, other than advise and be idiots, do they do anything?
Well, I don't know if that's fair, Dean Haglund.
Okay, you're
right. I mean, I think much of what he wrote, I think the point that he was making is probably true to the challenge that Romney faces.
Sure.
Intensity
and passion
is very important.
Right.
For someone to get elected.
Right.
And with Romney now losing so many of the potential independent voters with whom he was leading just a few months ago, it really is going... He can't afford not to have a huge turnout of conservatives.
Right. His core base.
And yet, you know, without that kind of passionate feeling towards him, it will be really quite challenging. So I feel
like eating your vegetables. Eat your vegetables.
Isn't that an odd thing? And for someone who is in a position of being a spokesperson for a group called the Family Research Council, wouldn't you hope that he would choose his words more carefully and not send the message that eating vegetables is an obligation?
Right.
Shouldn't anyone who's making any kind of speech on behalf of families be encouraging good physical health?
And, yes, and nutrition. Oh, well. How did this come up again?
I read that.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Things, when we're on the road in the middle of the night...
yes. And then things seem...
For example, this. I mean, I'm jumping all over the place here. But, you know, the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA have merged.
Yeah, yeah.
They are now officially one union.
Called SAG-AFTRA.
That's a clever name.
Yeah. Why not after SAG?
Because it sounds too much like aftermash.
Which?
Was an absolute failure. But did employ most of the members of both SAG and AFTRA. I don't know. I got nothing. But do you remember my argument as we were leading up to SAG and AFTRA that if this merger passed, I wanted this to only be the beginning. I would like to see mergers of all performing unions.
Right.
Because
the
I would...
The Guild and the Magicians Union and the whole...
Equity. Thing.
Equity.
Whatever agency represents musicians and singers.
Right. SOCAM and...
Recording artists. You know, who performers are negotiating against are multinational corporations that own
big multi
production and distribution in so many different fields of the performing arts.
Right.
And I had suggested, for example, with Equity, you know, people thought, well, Equity, you know, stage union, that doesn't make a lot of money, that doesn't have a lot of power. And I had suggested the fact that having Equity on board to put potential pressure on, say, a Walt Disney Corporation,
right,
which makes more money from its live shows than it ever does from movies or television.
That's right.
Might really be powerful. And I use, if I may, if it pleases the court.
The court is pleased.
I submit as Exhibit A,
uh-huh,
the fact that The Lion King just became the most successful Broadway show of all time.
What?
Having made more than $850 million on Broadway.
What?
And $4.8 billion in worldwide grosses.
Holy smokes.
And by the way, that's only the second most successful worldwide production. Most successful is, I think, Phantom at $5.6 billion.
Holy man.
Most successful film of all time, of course, has made $2 billion worldwide.
Right.
So, you know, we're talking about Lion King having made 2.5 times more than that. So this was the point that I was getting at.
That's
some big money, and if you can find a way as a performers' union to put pressure on in negotiations against these few multinational corporations that we refer to as the producers,
right?
Maybe then you really are getting somewhere.
That's a good point, because often now a lot of Broadway plays are taken from previous movies and. I'm thinking Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, which I'm not planning to see. But that you have across the board, you know, that was what unionization was in the first place, that you have a strength and power through the multitude and not the individual negotiating contract by contract.
We are here in Sacramento not only to appear...
West Sacramento.
On Good Day Sacramento. We are also screening tonight The Truth Is Out There.
Yes.
As part of Movies on a Big Screen.
The big screen.
At the Guild Theater here in Sacramento at 6:30.
So excited.
By the time you hear this, it will be over.
Don't bother coming.
I will be dead.
Lynched.
And no matter where I am, it won't smell very good. But the reason I bring this up is because you, yes, you, our loyal listeners, will have chances to see The Truth Is Out There in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
Three chances.
Just the three.
On Tuesday, May the 1st.
Yeah.
At Goldsmith College, the University of London.
Right.
Hosted by Professor Chris French, who specializes in the psychology of belief. We will be having a screening.
Oh, cool.
At the University of Lincoln,
uh-huh,
on the 2nd of May, there will be a screening. And at the Birmingham UFO Group in Birmingham on the 3rd of May. So three chances thus far in the United Kingdom set up. And if people go to the website truth-is-out-there.com,
rolls off the tongue,
they can find all the details of how and when to attend a screening in their area.
Fantastic. And you're leaving when? You're leaving the day before. So basically you're...
29th, I think.
So you're going to be completely jet-lagged as you show.
I'll arrive on the 30th. I'm staying at a hotel near the airport. Everyone, feel free to just drop by. Say hello. And then I'll go on into the university the next day. So I've got a good, one night to catch up.
There you go.
Dean Haglund, there is another website, I think, is there not, that you would like people to visit?
Of course. Thank you, Phil. As one knows, for those who don't know, I am also an artist, as well as a raconteur, inventor, and all the rest. And
modern dance
modern
student.
Dance
punk and rock drummer.
I am started a Kickstarter campaign for a graphic novel that in no way is about the lone gunman, but a story about three guys who go to Iraq and find the real reason for the invasion in 2003.
I feel like I wrote, along with you, a script that was very similar to this, and also in no way was The Lone Gunman from a beloved television series. This is about three journalists,
right,
who are on the fringe. They're independent journalists.
They are.
And they have gone deep, deep undercover.
Yes.
And they are investigating the real reasons that war was waged in Iraq.
Yes.
Real reason for the invasion of Baghdad.
And we're not giving away anything. So, but anyway, it's a Kickstarter campaign.
What's the name of it, of this graphic novel?
Why, it's going to be called Shock and Awesome. What do you think? Pretty funny, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're already off to a flying start. Lots of people have already come in as backers.
Now, when you say Kickstarter, this is one of those things where people can donate, and for donating, they can get gifts.
No, rewards.
Given to them.
And I'm doing it a bit backwards, because even the smallest donation gets you original artwork. So each level that you go up, you get some original artwork. We'll be throwing in signed 8x10s, other comic books, other works that I've done, and it goes all the way up to the high end of $1,000, where you get original oil paintings. I help with your Christmas cards this year. You get a tour of downtown Los Angeles is one of the reward levels. So tons of stuff coming from my studios to you when you back my graphic novel on Kickstarter. So check that out. And
how can people find that?
Well, you go to Kickstarter.com and then you search for Dean Haglund or Shock and Awesome is a good way to remember it.
And also on the Chilpack Hollywood website, chilpackhollywood.com, where you can download and stream so many of the episodes that we've done.
Yes.
And also through the website, subscribe via iTunes and really simple syndication. Right there on the website in the description of this week's show, we'll make sure that there is a link to Shock and Awesome.
Thank you. Yes, what a great way of funding creative projects through crowdsourcing dollars.
And this is the thing also where I think it's really important. So often, you know, we're inundated with worthy causes and you know, requests for help all the time. All of us are in email and all these sort of things. I think the two things about Kickstarter that are important is, well, one, in the case of Shock and Awesome, you made a trailer that's hilarious.
Oh, thank you.
So everyone should go to the page to watch the trailer. Don't feel that by watching the trailer you're guilted in to making a contribution. The trailer's there for everyone to see, to be entertaining, so enjoy it. You will get a kick out of it. It's what? It's a couple minutes long.
It's 2 minutes long.
It's hilarious. Oh. And then the other thing is that you hope in kind of the community effort of Kickstarter. It's two things, right? It's not just raising money
right.
for a project. It's also starting to get the word out there about the project.
Right, that it's so, not the marketing, but the brand, the
awareness.
Idea. Yeah, that you're aware that I'm actually creating a...
So everyone who goes there and sees that trailer, if you think that it's funny, if you like the idea, if you're amused by it in any way, please pass it along to anyone you think also will find it amusing, who's interested in art, who's interested in three, in the Lone Gunman. Well, are interested maybe in characters like the Lone
right,
Gunman.
Lone
if there was a graphic novel about three characters very much like them,
right?
Whose deaths were maybe staged so that they could go deep undercover, then this might be the graphic novel for just such a person.
Thing.
But anyway, if you know anyone who gets a kick out of these things, then please, by all means, share it with people.
Yes, thank you.
And now, Dean Haglund.
Oh, yes.
Even here in West Hills, Sacramento.
West Hills?
West Hills?
I haven't seen a single tree.
I don't know. It's the city of trees. We have not slept in days. We're unlikely to for the near future.
We started driving at 2 a.m.
Nevertheless, here it is, your live event of the week.
Uh-huh. What's that going to be?
I saw quite an amazing live event. One of the things that almost kind of ruined me for both live events and for movies.
Forever.
For a little while, anyway. At the Samuel Oshin Planetarium at Griffith Park.
Oh, yes, the lovely planetarium up at the historic where they filmed James Dean and Rebel Without a Cause. That one?
Yeah. The newly designed for the renovation.
Yes, fantastic.
Planetarium, I saw a presentation called Centered in the Universe.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And this is combines live performance and live narration with a filmed piece. And it is astounding to me that in an age where so much is made of 3D and so much money is spent on IMAX tickets and all these sort of things, it's like, hello, you want the future of immersive cinema? This is it.
okay.
I mean, you're reclining back in your seat.
Uh-huh, and you're looking up on the planetarium ceiling.
And the whole curved planetarium ceiling becomes the image into which you move, and you are convinced that you are moving through all of it. Oh, a lot of people have to close their eyes because they're
motion sick.
Because they're getting motion sick because of the illusion of movement.
So where's the live performer? Is he hanging from the ceiling? How do you see him?
What's wonderful is that he introduces it. He performs in the center because the center is kind of in the round. The audience is in the round.
But it's got that projector thing.
And right, and he works around the projector. Well, before the projector rises.
Yeah.
And he does some sleight of hand, some magic, introduces himself, introduces the topics with narration, and then narrates the entire film. The film's narration is never recorded. It's performed live there on the spot with someone watching it with you.
Wow. So he's memorized the whole show, or is he improvising it each night, or you don't know?
I think it's probably a scripted thing, like a, you know, a play, yeah, such as people do. They get a part, and they
memorize,
they memorize it, yeah.
So yeah. In the world of improv.
So, right. This is nothing. I didn't say at the improvisational planetarium.
Because I thought maybe, I don't know, that... So he's standing on the ground, walking around, narrating the thing, and this guy is, and you're flying in space. Is that the
show? Oh my goodness! When we entered the library at Alexandria,
what?
My jaw would have hit the floor if I wasn't reclined back, because we were there. We were there and completely immersed in the library at Alexandria. And when it returns us from the farthest reaches of space to the actual Griffith Park Observatory at night, you see this return. I half expected to see myself walking out of the observatory because I felt like I was outside looking in. It was the coolest thing. And I must say that, again, this is one of those films that I love so much because it talks about how much we don't know, and it talks about how already we're starting to learn that much of what we accepted over the last century may not reveal... you know, vis-a-vis dark matter and dark energy.
Yeah.
Our discoveries of these things are starting to reveal that everything we thought for the last century, aha, we'd finally got it. Oh, no, now we've got to deepen our relationship to these questions yet again.
Right.
And it was very inspiring and very moving, and it was one of those films that makes you feel good to be part of a curious species.
That is continually discovering stuff.
And wants to discover stuff.
Right.
And, you know, the movie does a good job of pointing out that how many wonderful facets of life that we take for granted were developed because of someone just being interested in studying something.
Right.
Not like, I want to invent something that transforms communication. No, it was, I want to ask questions about how the universe, like Tesla. Right? He didn't want to transform anything in the sense of a product. He was asking questions about the world in which we live.
Yeah.
And studying that and trying to come up with answers. And as a result, so many wonderful innovations have taken hold.
Huh. How long does the show run? Now I want to see it.
It's about an hour long.
And
it shows several times a day. They do other shows there as well. So anyway, always worth a visit. The new exhibits since... I had not been there since the renovation.
Oh, you haven't? Oh,
even though I live right in the shadow of it.
You live in the shadow of it. Did you go in the room where the wall... I mean, it's like, what, 60 feet? And it's a star map? Or just a picture of stars. And they said that's what you... If you put your hand out, that's the amount of sky taken up by your fingernail. And it was 60 feet long photograph of a million stars.
There's the world's largest photograph from Palomar, right? Palomar, that shows all of distant space.
Right.
But I didn't see my fingernails up on the wall at any point.
No,
but
not
I,
your fingernails. It's the amount of... Oh, for crying out loud.
I know that you actually saw a movie.
Yes.
So, Jesus.
And was that too loud for you?
It was a little loud, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, and you know what?
So you've seen, I think, two movies this year. You're
I'm way ahead
a fifth of a way through a top 10 list.
yes. See, because I am Captain Spoiler, I think I shouldn't talk about this because if I reveal anything, it'll ruin it for everyone else. And I'm talking about Joss Whedon's Cabin in the Woods. This is an awesome horror movie that's very clever, not very... Well, and it's got scares, too, in there. But it's also clever. And to say more about it is actually to ruin it. So in an effort not to be Mr. Spoiler, like I have been on so many episodes of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, I am going to show restraint this time and just say how much I enjoyed it, and I insist you go see it so that we can talk about it.
The comparison that I've read again and again is to Scream. Is that an apt comparison?
It is mildly apt in that it takes a chainsaw to the Cabin in the Woods genre. And
do the characters within the film have an awareness of the genre that they are in?
No, and yes.
So there is a self-reflexive element
to it. Very much a self-reflexive element, but there's... it's almost... There's two worlds going on that seem incompatible that then mesh together.
Speaking of two worlds that seem incompatible and then prove... to be incompatible.
We're talking Dean Haglund and Phil Lernes. No.
We're talking Sacramento and a morning news show. I saw the latest film released last year here in the U.S. from Alex de la Iglesia, the director of El Crimen Perfecto.
Of course.
A Perfect Crime.
Perfect Crime.
Called The Last Circus.
Right.
And... this begins by telling the account of a machete-wielding clown, circus clown, who...
goes on a murderous rampage.
No, not a murderous rampage. He killed the whole regiment of troops during the Spanish Civil War.
Of course.
And it then flash-forwards many decades and tells the story of his son, who hopes to avenge his clown father's death, and he... follows in his footsteps in many ways, including becoming a clown, though he has to become the sad clown because he doesn't have any laughter in his life. This
the worst pitch ever.
This movie, I saw the trailer and it was sort of the weirdest trailer I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
And so I had to see it. And there were some striking images and some stuff that just seemed so cool. And the interesting thing is, the stuff in the trailer that seemed so cool was the worst stuff in the movie.
Ah, really?
Was all the stuff that made me really dislike the movie.
Oh.
You know, it's a... how can I best describe it other than 107 minutes of my life I will never get back?
It's too bad.
And at the same time, it's the Citizen Kane of machete-wielding Spanish Civil War clown movies.
Right. There's not a lot of those.
It's the best that I've ever seen.
There's Devil's Rejects and Insane Clown Posse, I guess.
Those dealt with Spanish Civil War, did they?
Yeah, well, as a metaphor.
I saw a little independent film.
Uh-huh.
I joke, and yet it is shot like an independent film. The Hunger Games. Have you heard of this?
I heard of it as Battle Royale.
We talked about this.
Yes.
We talked about this. And Stephen King... heard about Battle Royale and the two things that Battle Royale stole from him, you know?
Right.
So, anyway,
continues.
Gary Ross directed this. It really is shot like an independent film. It's very interesting. It was not a big budget film, and in the scenes of epic scope that it needs, the seams are showing.
Right. A little creaky.
The mat work is not so polished, and skimping on the costumes when you've got crowd shots.
Oh, really?
You know, well, they won't see it. You know, we'll blend in extras that aren't dressed for these scenes amidst the ones who are. And just little things like this that you do, especially in an independent film. Gary Ross, the maker of this film, was an interesting choice to make The Hunger Games because he is a good, solid storyteller.
Right.
Two films previous, Pleasantville and Seabiscuit.
Oh, yeah.
Both of which got great acclaim.
Right.
Were somewhat straight ahead. In a way, if they were disappointing, they were disappointing because you kind of felt that maybe someone a little more visionary could have gone further with them.
Right.
But he kind of seems to me to be sort of the the solid professional craftsman that, and I don't mean it as a backhanded compliment, but that studio directors used to be.
Right.
Your Michael Curtizes, for example.
Yes.
Or even Sir Carol Reed, who made, you know, one of my favorite films, The Third Man. But it was hard to really argue he was an auteur because he always had a different style for each film that fit the subject.
Right.
But he really was more of a studio kind of director than who. Yeah. Robert Wise was another one of these guys, really.
Great point.
Gary Ross seems to be kind of in that vein.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he's the son of cable television's artist, Demo Bob Ross. Isn't that the...
Is that true? You're making that up.
I'm not sure.
Oh, my goodness. You can't just drop that. I only just found out who Bob Ross is.
Are you kidding? How did you not see him all those years of that afro and painting?
And by the way, there are some very happy clouds.
Happy
I see
clouds.
Very happy clouds over here. Very happy clouds. That's what Bob Ross always said. Well, we're going to paint some happy clouds. Some happy clouds.
Just a tree? That feels good. That's nice.
I don't know that about Gary Ross. I'm going to have to look this up. And if you're right, I will doff my cap to you. And if not, I will blame you for distracting from the conversation about the Hunger Games. Now, Gary Ross is not coming back, despite Lionsgate wanting him to, is not coming back to do the sequels to Hunger Games. And in fact, they're talking about, or they're negotiating with Cuarón.
Oh, see that one.
Who did the best Harry Potter, Prisoner of Azkaban, and also, of course, Children of Men, and whose
favorite.
Gravity is coming out this year, and we can't wait for it,
the
space-bound 3D movie. And Iñárritu, whose first name escapes me, but the director of Beautiful.
Yeah, that's a good choice.
So another independent kind of filmmaker who gets great performances and who really has a very personal sort of stamp on his projects. And David Cronenberg.
What?
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, that is interesting.
That?
So that would make Hunger Games more hunger than gamey.
I mean, it really makes you think they must be going deeper into the dystopian nature of this future that they're depicting.
Right.
I did not enjoy the film. I'm not going to say that it was a bad film. I thought structurally it was very pleasing. You know, I could see the beats. I liked that the games themselves begin exactly halfway through. It was well laid out structurally. I could see how it could let everyone in. I don't have a criticism of the film per se.
Right.
It wasn't interesting to me.
Yeah.
And it certainly wasn't entertaining to me. But it wasn't.
Right.
And I could see where it would be for many people. And certainly, of course, these are huge hits.
Well, yeah. And I actually not going to see it because I saw it on YouTube done with Beanie Babies. And
That's funny.
And it was really well done. And it's the whole plot. And it was highly entertaining. So I think seeing it for 2 hours would dull me.
And seeing it for 2 hours and 25 minutes. The part that I want to talk about, though, is what disturbs me about this film and about its success.
Okay.
And I haven't felt disturbed about how a film, about an audience's response to a film, since talking to people after Drive came out. Now, I really liked Drive a great deal, but as you might remember, I was disturbed by how many women, in particular, found Ryan Gosling's character in Drive to be such a romantic figure.
Oh.
When the character's a sociopath.
Right.
To me, the film was a modern-day Taxi Driver, and it even made allusions to Taxi Driver, not the least of which is having one of the stars of Taxi Driver, Albert Brooks, star in Drive.
Okay.
The difference is that in the movie Taxi Driver, the Travis Bickle character, the sociopath character, was championed as a hero by the world within the movie. But we in the audience are left feeling very uncomfortable because we recognize that he has a mental illness.
Right.
Flash forward to Drive, and the character has a mental illness, and he's treated that way within the world of the film. But so many of the people in the audience, again, found him really this romantic figure. And that disturbed me.
Because he wasn't being sullen and had a mohawk
and all of that. I mean,
yeah, he had a good haircut, but he was being sullen. I mean, he had all the earmarks of a sociopath.
Right.
So with Hunger Games, I find myself disturbed again by the reaction to it.
Because?
Well, here's a work that it's about a dystopian future.
Yeah.
Where children are forced to battle against each other to the death.
Right.
For the
freedom,
entertainment of the population.
Right. So that
and to have that film embraced so passionately by audiences the world over.
Yeah.
Doesn't that mean, by definition, we are in fact living in that dystopian future? Because this is a movie that's depicting those children battling each other to the death, dying on screen, bleeding on screen, getting maimed on screen for our entertainment, and we are eating it up.
Well, but I mean, to a degree, it's like saying, well, Twilight is a champion getting married to vampires.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, look, we've talked about it before. I mean, the Twilight mythology and its thinly veiled Mormon propaganda behind it is disturbing to me. Far more disturbing to me, though, is, you know, again, when anything that isn't competently done gets that kind of response, that disturbs me. But I don't bother having more of a conversation about it than that, because my job is to just try to do my things at least competently.
Right.
But here is a film that is well done. This is the story that they wanted to make. And I understand that there is one slim difference, which is, of course, these aren't real kids fighting. Yeah. You know, they aren't really fighting to the death.
No.
They're pretending to fight to the death for our entertainment. I understand that we live in a world where we ruin 10-year-olds' bodies by having them compete in the Olympics in women's gymnastics. Women's gymnastics when they're 10-year-old girls. I understand that we have childhood beauty pageants.
Yeah, you watch Toddlers and Tears.
We have been objectifying children for many, many years now. This is nothing new.
Uh-huh.
And I'm disturbed that an entire franchise is built upon selling children fighting as a source of entertainment, and that the audience feels like they're let off the hook because, unlike the world in the movie, no one's being forced to.
Right. They're not... Well...
I mean, when has a dystopian version of the future ever been so lovingly embraced as a commercial
entity? Running Man? Was that? No. I'm just all...
Which was one of the things that Battle Royale was sued for being based
like
on. Yeah.
I know, right? Well, and here's the thing. There's a bunch of hot young actors that, of course, are finding their tween demographic that all are supporting that movie. Like, who's actually going to that movie? It's not...
But it's fascinating. There was so much pent-up demand for this based on the love of the books, but it really is interesting. I mean, think about it. The great dystopian... The idea of something dystopian being commercial is so fascinating. And that almost delights me. Again, I just, through the prism of which I view these things, I have a hard time. I don't like when... Look, I don't like in movies when the peril of a child is a go-to card to create anxiety and to manipulate an audience.
Dramatic tension and all that.
Yeah. Now, if you're telling the story of the Lindbergh baby kidnapping,
yeah.
Well, look, a child's going to be in peril.
Right.
We understand that. That's a real-life story. But as a filmmaker, if that's what you're relying on, oh, you know what? We can give them a kid, and the kid can get kidnapped.
Right. And that puts a time pressure on it and all that.
That'll make the audience care. Well, that's so manipulative to the point and exploitive to the point of being really crass and cynical. And
Now, are you saying then that by whoever, I haven't seen it, but by society embracing Hunger Games, we are then marching towards that dystopian future.
Or we're already there, because we're already using... this is the interesting point. At some point, us being able to accept and embrace the idea means that the idea, even in stories, means that the idea is real. Why were certain people from the very outset so able to predict that seemingly unexpectedly Barack Obama would be able to beat Hillary Clinton and the Clinton machine in the primaries, when everything for months leading up to it said, well, he doesn't have a chance. He's just running to set the stage for 4 years hence. And yet some keen observers of society knew that he was going to win, because movies and television shows that feature black presidents are successful. Movies and TV shows that feature women presidents, not nearly as successful. So fiction had already shown us that the idea of a black president had been accepted.
Right.
The idea of a woman president had not been accepted.
Interesting.
So I guess the comparison here is, yes, at what point does the idea of seeing children bleed and get injured and having that be accepted and embraced, at what point does that make it, we're okay with that?
Yeah. Well, and I turn you to...
We certainly are, as we've discussed, okay with children being exploited in certain ways.
Now, have you seen that...
They do great work on my Nikes, for example. Those little teeny hands and fingers, they do great work.
I pointed out, have you seen that four-minute movie out of Mexico, which are children shown as the drug war... it's a mini version of the drug war. And so there's young kids playing corrupt politicians, and they're smoking cigarettes. And then the other kids are the policia in bulletproof vests, and they're arresting drug lords, and they're throwing them in jail. And the whole idea is that, you know, how do we stop this drug war if we know the next generation is going to be doing this?
Oh, that's fascinating.
And it's done all with like 5 to 7 to 8 year olds. And they're all acting these parts. And it's a 4 minute film that's really well done. But it's the same idea of this dystopian future. Have we already accepted the idea that our future is going to be this kind of bloodshed and this kind of...
I want to see that. You're going to have to show that to me.
That's a YouTube hit now.
We're going to have to stop here because we are 2 minutes over.
Oh, my God.
And it's burning up in this car.
So hot.
We've told you about the website. Follow Dean Haglin on Twitter.
I'm at @DHaglin.
Follow me. I'm Phil Lernis. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Belated spoiler alert.